Thank you for tuning into this episode of PageCast, presented by Jonathan Ball Publishers. Today's episode features Crash and Burn by Glenn Osmond. This insider's tale, narrated by Glenn, chronicles the South African airline industry over the past 30 years, highlighting the dramatic collapse of Comair in 2022. Osmond, twice the CEO of Comair and founder CEO of Onetime, guides readers through the fiercely competitive, low-cost airline sector that surged after the 1990s. Comair, operating Kulula and British Airways, and Onetime led this wave, transforming domestic flying and tourism. Despite a 75-year profit history, Comair fell due to the pandemic, regulatory issues, and poor management decisions. Expect stories of industry legends, innovations, fierce competition, pilot accountant conflicts, union boss disputes, and shareholder director battles. In this episode, Glenn engages in a captivating conversation with David O'Sullivan, broadcaster, writer, and media consultant. Enjoy.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this interview with Glenn Osmond, who I can only describe as an aviation veteran, a man I've interviewed a couple of times, not as many times as my colleague Bruce Whitfield did on 702. My name's David O'Sullivan. I'm a former broadcaster. I used to be at 702 and Kai FM. Most recently, I've morphed into being an author. I wrote Rassie Erasmus's memoir with him. And it gave me great pleasure then to read a book about the aviation industry that is something of a memoir as well. This is the book, Crash and Burn, by Glenn Osmond. And I found that there was a little bit of an overlap that he and I had in terms of our academic careers at Rhodes University. Glenn, it's a pleasure to chat to you. And I think this would be the first time that I would talk to you and not mention anything about a plane being grounded or flights being suspended or flights being delayed. It's all about your book.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me, David. I look forward to the chat.
Glenn, I didn't realize until I read the book that we had this time at Rhodes University, though we didn't know each other. I was studying journalism. You were in the accounting department. But what did amuse me was that as a footballer, you were playing for Graham House, which is one of the university residences, for those who don't know, Rhodes University. At the time, the law school soccer team was the dominant team. And in your year, one of the years you were playing, Graham House won everything, and you were awarded with the Prick of the Year Award. The reason I raise this right up is that I know all those guys at law school. And I remember that the Prick of the Year Award was something that they agonized over. And it wasn't a throwaway, let's give it to somebody we hated. They gave it to the person who gave them the most trouble. It was almost a sign of acknowledgement of somebody else's prowess. So I felt it wasn't an insult. It was an acknowledgement. You got the better of them. Tell me about your university time and studying accountancy and clearly not being in the mold of a boring old accountant.
A surprising introduction, but thank you, David. I remember law school quite well. And I had a few friends, I think, in the law department as well as in the journal department. So even though we might not have known each other, there would have been some shared friends somewhere along the line, I think. If I look at the award, I think what I lacked in footballing ability, I made up in attitude. So I used to do crash tackles all around the field simply because I didn't have the greatest ability. So perhaps that's where the award. Yes, it was 1980s in Eastern Cape were really tumultuous years, if you talk about it. So I arrived at university fresh from the army. I had a huge culture shock, you know, from the one environment to the other. I loved my years at Rhodes, three happiest years of my life. I would gladly have spent more. Unfortunately, I had to go and work to pay back a bursary. In fact, one of my sons went to Rhodes for, I think, 7 years. So he did quite well, managing to extend it a lot longer than I'd managed. So I enjoyed my years there. I like to think I had the right work-lifestyle balance at the time, which probably later on in life I lost it, but I seemed to perfect it at the time. So I managed to pass. I managed to enjoy my years as well. And, you know, the 1980s were tough, as you know. It's probably in South Africa's history, those years were probably early 80s to the late 80s were really tough. But being a student in Grahamstown, you're aware of it, but you're still in a student life, which I think you probably know more than me, working in the journal department at the time.
The townships were in flames. Books have now been written about it. We did live in the middle of the revolution, and I think you were also at the time where there were a lot of police spies on campus. The reason I raised the Prick of the Year award is not just so that we can say Prick of the Year on this podcast, but because it told me so much about your early personality. And what you've left out about your academic career is that you excel. You graduated with distinction in accounting. And so quite clearly, you had the abilities as an accountant. But because you had been given this award, it told me something about your personality, that you could be abrasive as well, that you would be hard-headed, because that's the caliber of person who normally got that award. As I read the book, it seems to me that that is the kind of personality that you needed to have, a big, thick skin, bombastic, and an astute mind for the numbers in order to succeed in the aviation industry. Would that be a fair analysis?
I really struggle to talk about myself when it comes to personality and personal characteristics and so forth. What I found with accounting is I found accounting easy. So it was obviously a lot easier than science or medicine or law or any of the other topics. So I sort of drifted into accounting simply because I found it relatively easy. Somehow it's got a certain logic, I suppose, that might have appealed to me. I've treated accounting, I've treated running airlines always as an accounting problem, not as aircraft boys with their toys sort of problem that needs to be solved. So simplistically, I've always applied those accounting principles in order to arrive at a profit and ensure that a business remains sustainable. So it sounds boring, but at heart, I'm an accountant in my approach of running approach to running a business.
Well, that is quite clear from your book. I think right at the outset, you say that you couldn't tell the difference between a Boeing and an Airbus, and I presume that is still the case, is it, Glenn?
Yeah, but they really do look similar on the tarmacs. It is hard to tell the difference.
Exactly. The thing about it is, though, when I look at the personalities that you come up against, they're hard-headed people. And the fact that you survived for as long as you did and did as much as you did, you couldn't be a shrinking violet in that environment when you're dealing with the kinds of people that were running at various times Comair. Well, you joined forces with Rodney James to do one time, but the people who had SAA, for example, SAFAIR, they're intriguing characters, and you bash heads quite significantly with them. So for you to be in that environment, you clearly were able to stand and go toe-to-toe with them, and I felt that that was important to understand right at the outset. But let's just reflect on how you got into the aviation industry, because quite clearly you weren't a little boy who collected model aircraft and built planes and went to the airport and did plane spotting. It seems that almost you fell into it because you were working in the formative years of your career, working for, was it Standard Bank, and you were out in the great metropolis of Mafeking.
Yes, I was at Price Waterhouse at the time. I had to do 3-year articles. I managed to get articles in Mafeking. I remember, I think at the time, I tried to get articles in Port Elizabeth, and they were paying $1,300 a month, and Pricewaterhouse Mafeking were paying R3,000 a month. So I made the big move for the extra R2,000, which enabled me to start paying off my student debts. And it worked out quite well because I finished my articles at Pricewaterhouse. I ended up going to Abra, happened to meet the CEO of the local airline, Bob Air, at the time. And he said he was looking for a CEO. He's had just left and moved across to Comair, which I think you'll pick up in the book. It's a really an incestuous industry. You know, people are moving between the airlines all the time. So I ended up in aviation as a chance encounter at Abra. Someone said he was looking for a financial manager. I was available, and that's how it started. I think on your earlier point, it is a tough industry. The individuals who succeed are tough. In fact, the ones who fail are probably as tough as well. So there are strong characters. I've dealt with them over the past 20, 30 years, which I also talk about in the book. You know, an airline's not just an accounting problem. It's also a people problem. Most businesses are about people. The successes and failures are about the people who either made the right calls or made the wrong calls. And I also talk about how so many businesses of these important strategic business decisions are made around personality and character and personal likes or personal dislikes of your competitors. I don't know if that's unique to aviation, but it's particularly strong in aviation. Strong characters who don't really all like each other that much.
It was also the reason, if we're talking personalities and people problems, it was obviously the reason why ultimately you had to leave what became Sunair. BOP Air morphed into Sunair as a result of the dissolution of the homelands. But you were working at that stage. The man in charge was Jan Borslap, who then hired his wife. And you found that wasn't something that sat easily with you. So it was less about your abilities to crunch the numbers and more about your inability to work in that space with Johan's wife and the new way of reporting that led to you leaving the business.
Yes, and that's really been some sort of trend or theme. You know, when I look back, I left Sunair because of a non-business reason. I left Comair because of a non-business reason. I left One Time because of a non-business reason. So I seem to be fine with handling numbers and running businesses, but I do sometimes struggle with these outside forces that often have nothing to do with business, some sort of office politics things. And I've always been really clear and determined in my mind. I always stay away from that. I have no interest in it, even if it's to my detriment. I focus on the job. I focus on what needs to be done. I try and stay true to my personal values and ethics. And if that leads to whatever it has in the past, I'm fine with that. I have no regrets on any of those.
Glenn, I did find you, and I still find you, and it's been confirmed in the book, to have been something of a different type of person in the aviation industry. And correct me if I'm wrong, because I felt that from interviewing and in encountering people in the aviation industry, they were all people who lived and breathed aeroplanes. It wasn't so much of, it sounds like an interesting job to go and do. It was a passion for them, rather like the broadcasting industry. There are very few people who get into broadcasting because they think, hell, well, let me give it a go. It's because they absolutely fundamentally have this in their blood. I didn't feel that you had it in your blood, but you had numbers in your blood. Have I understood that correctly, that you were drawn more by the challenge of the financial side of this business and less about the glamour of flying aeroplanes?
Yeah, it's important to be passionate. But for me, it came about being passionate for the business to succeed, you know, to beat the odds, to do well, to fight the big guys, to win the wars, win the battles. So it's possible to be really passionate about what you do, what really gets you going, without necessarily being passionate about aircraft. Aircraft are simply the asset you use in order to win the battle, in order to grow the business, in order to achieve profits.
I was wondering to what extent you were going to paint a picture of Glenn Osmond, the all-conquering hero who did nothing wrong and everybody around you was to blame for the demise of various airlines. But you really wear your heart on your sleeve, and you spoke quite candidly about your mistakes as well, which I think is very refreshing for anybody who wants to understand why things went wrong and how they went wrong. You seem to survive it when you make the wrong decisions when it came to the financial side of things. And I refer specifically here to when you were at Comair and you did a foreign currency deal that went terribly wrong. Tell us about that, the purchase of, what was it, three or four Boeing 737-400s for a huge amount of money in those days, 700 million rand in 2001. But then, of course, there was 9/11, the Twin Towers collapse, and the world turned upside down, impacting on a decision you made. Talk us through that.
Yes, I recall at the time I was a young FD. I was making exchange trades, foreign currency gains. I was doing quite well, making the company a few million in profits on foreign currency each year. So I was on a roll. And we then had to make this acquisition, or we then made an acquisition of three aircraft. The largest deal in Comair's history. I think the price for the three combined was about $60 million or thereabouts. I set up a foreign currency structure when we concluded the deal to purchase the aircraft, which was before 9/11, a month or two before, and then we had to pay for the aircraft a month or two after 9/11. So clearly I'd not foreseen any event like 9/11 happening. I'd made the mistake of really chasing the upside, making a big profit, making a big currency gain, and I failed to properly protect the downside. And what happened after 9/11, I remember watching the second aircraft crashing and, you know, the whole emotion of watching it happening. Little did I realize at the time that the impact of that second aircraft crashing on the industry would be huge. Three things happened simultaneously. People stopped flying. They were scared of flying. So passenger volumes dropped dramatically. Aircraft values just collapsed. So we just bought these three new aircraft and suddenly the aircraft values had halved in dollar terms immediately overnight, because if people aren't flying, aircraft values collapse. And then thirdly, the Rand wiped out, which had happened. So suddenly what happened is we had a US dollar debt, which increased significantly because of the Rand weakening. We then had the value of the asset that halved. So suddenly we were facing this huge foreign currency loss. And little did I realize that at the time I'd seen the crash. And also when I entered into the foreign currency hedge, I'd also not foreseen anything that dramatic. But still, I need to own that you shouldn't always only chase the upside, protect the downside. So I owned up to that error. And I think that affected my relationship with the chairman at the time. Once again, if they'd held their nerve, which even happens today, you know, the recent elections in South Africa, all the Joburg traders held their nerve. All the foreign traders got nervous. And in the end, the Joburg traders were a lot more right in terms of what was happening in the South African environment compared to the foreign traders. You know, the foreign traders, the Rand was going to break 20, was going to go to 21, 22. The local traders were, no, guys, it's not going to happen. And they proved to be right. Unfortunately, at the time, if we'd taken the advice of the local traders, that loss would have been avoided most definitely, and a gain would have been made.
Though, if you bring that in as an analogy there, Glenn, I think that the outcome that we saw politically was foreseeable. If we go back to 2001 and your foreign currency deal, what wasn't foreseeable was that people would crash planes into the World Trade Center. You said it damaged your relationship with the chairman. Was that Dave Novick at the time?
Yes. You know, if you look at commerce history, Dave Novick started there in the 1960s. And 90% of what I've learned in aviation, I learned from Dave. You know, he had the fundamentals, simple fundamentals of business. Low cost, protect cash, avoid debt. And I've tried to apply those three principles in my various stints in aviation, like if I look at over the last 30 years. And it's almost when one of those fails is generally when an airline is headed towards failure. So I'd learned that from Dave. I worked closely with Dave. I was a young CA at the time. He'd been around probably already 30 odd years at the time. But obviously when we incurred that loss on the foreign currency, it affected the relationship that I had with him.
When did you feel that I don't know if I could call it animosity, it doesn't seem to be animosity, but there was clearly a trust issue. You left Comair once Dave brought his son Gideon into the business as well. Did you feel that Dave no longer trusted you to handle the finances as he had in the past, the reason for having brought you on board with Piet van Hoeven in the first place?
No, I think if he'd lost the trust, he would have fired me without a blink of an eye. It really wouldn't have been something he would have agonized over. So what happened at the time that was me to stay on, I tendered my resignation. I felt I had made a mistake. I tendered my resignation. They asked me to stay on. But somehow never fully recovers. And me leaving Comair really wasn't about the arrival of Gideon at Comair. It was more, I felt that the level of trust between myself and the chairman was not at the same level it was. And also there was a problem at the time in Kaluo, at the time in Comair, they were losing control of their costs. So we saw an opportunity in the market for a new entrant. So what I was saying to the guys at Comair, look, if I don't do it, someone else is going to do it. Someone else is going to start up a new airline. So you'll have the premium carrier will be BA, in the middle will be Kaluo, and some new entrant will own a segment right at the bottom of the market. So my proposal to Comair was, well, I'm going to try it. I had no money. I just had a spreadsheet, but still, it's something that I was going to try. And I asked them to share in it with us, myself, Rodney, and Michael Kaminski, the other guys who started it up with me. Unfortunately, at first they said, yeah, they'd be open to it, because that would have been ideal. if they'd owned a chunk of the new airline, we would have had access to capital and we could have achieved low costs and really owned the whole South African market, the premium segment, the middle segment, and the true low-cost segment. So I think it was a missed opportunity on the side of Comair when they said no to me. Not only a missed opportunity in that they might have owned the whole market, but a missed opportunity where it cost them hundreds of millions in terms of lost revenue, lost market share, lost profits, and so forth. So I think it was a missed opportunity.
Just on that point, though, did they not want to go with it? This was obviously your idea for one time. Cholula was at that stage going really well. In fact, you referred to it as the golden era of air travel when Cholula was up and running and flourishing. Did they possibly see one time as a rival to Cholula, which is why they didn't want to get involved? Obviously, you saw a niche for both to operate successfully.
Yeah. So what I was trying to say is one time in some form or other would happen with or without me. My proposal was, if it's going to happen, if it's inevitable, rather own a share of it. And in fact, when I spoke to Piet van Werffen, the chairman, the CEO, he supported it 100%. And he said, come see me in a week's time. And a week's time, we went back, Rodney and myself, and we met the chairman, Dave Novick, and he was furious. He was absolutely furious. There was no sober business approach to making the decision. It was simply, this is my scar. I will not let you in my scar. If you dare come into my scar, I will take you out. You know, it was that simple. In fact, he even said, I'll put 100 million aside to force you guys out if you do start. So we started one time under no illusions at all that we had this huge competitor who was going to take us out. So I always say, like, one time, I don't think we went to work every day. We went to war every day because the war started even before our first flight. And it didn't end for 8 years, you know. So we fought that war, and it was great. We were small. We were motivated. Our fear of failure was massive. We had nowhere to go. So we just fought them every day on every imaginable thing. So those were great 8 years in my career.
That is described as the glory days, and you're talking, I think, almost from a personal perspective. But you detail the battles that you were fighting for market share and against some very jealous rivals as well. It seems to me it would be tough all the time, and it goes back to the original point I was making about you and your personality, that you're a tough guy. You can stand toe-to-toe with the bigger boys. With one time, you were doing that on a regular basis, it seems, but you've just told us how much you enjoyed that. Is that part of your makeup, Glenn, that having these kind of battles is where you get your kicks?
I'm not great at self-analysis, but, you know, what our sort of war cries at one time were, you know, we fear no wars, we start wars, and we are invincible. So it sort of created that culture. But it was all about succeeding as a business. That was what we needed to do to succeed as a business. And, you know, I think we started that airline, the founders, we had 4 million rand. I'd worked out we needed 25, 30 million to start. Somehow we managed to raise only 10, and we actually started the business with 10 million. And I think within 3 to 4 years, we'd listed it on the JSE. We had turnover of over a billion. Profits, or our market cap was around about 230 million, I think, when we listed. So it was a great success story. And in fact, it helped us that we had the strong enemy who wanted to wipe us out, that focused us on our business, focused us on cost, focused us on customer service. So it actually helped, surprisingly, in a way.
Well, I think people watching this will remember with some fondness the time where we had this variety of airlines to choose from, and remember the days of one time. Talk us through what happened. Why is one time no longer with us? Where do you point the fingers, Glenn?
Look, I wouldn't point fingers. What happened at one time is we had that fuel crisis when the Americans invaded Iraq. Once again, watching on TV, America's invading Iraq, little did I realize then that it would have such a severe impact on me. So after Iraq, the price of oil rocketed. And the one weakness in one time's business model is our aircraft were fuel inefficient. If fuel went up at $70, we were okay in the market. We could beat anyone. At $100, it became tight. At $120, it was really tough. And we were also fine if it was $120 for a month or two, but it sort of held at $120, I think, for close to a year. So we had the most fuel inefficient aircraft in South Africa, and the fuel price was high. So we had to raise capital, which we raised. And unfortunately, when we raised the capital, the founding shareholders lost control. So previously, we had control of the business. We lost control to a consortium of the other shareholders. And they wanted me out. They wanted the founders out. And they made the change dramatically. I presented some proposals to the board. And for the first time of presenting to the board for 8 years, they rejected all my proposals. And I was a bit slow, and I realized, whoa, there's something going on here. And actually, there'd been an agreement from the other shareholders for them to remove the founders from the board. So it happened. I resigned the next day, and the new shareholders took control of one time. Unfortunately, they made a lot of mistakes, raised costs, lowered revenue, and a year and a half later, it folded.
Well, you say you're not going to point fingers, but I think you've actually identified quite clearly in the book and now as well who the personalities were and why things were going wrong. Obviously, it's spelt out in more detail in the book. There's so much to talk about, but I do want to touch on the battles that you had to fight with trade unions. And it's not just the cabin crew trade unions, but if I could call the pilots association, it's a trade union of sorts, isn't it? But the pilots and you, that was an ongoing battle, wasn't it? You didn't see eye to eye with their work ethic, their working hours, and their approach. They, at the same time, didn't like the rules that you were trying to, I don't know if enforce or to impose on them by asking them to fly more often. Just give us a snapshot of those kinds of battles that you had to fight with the pilots.
It's an age-old problem that fights between management and pilots. It's not unique to me. It's not unique to South Africa, and it's not unique to any of the airlines I worked at. What you typically find a pilot flying Joburg, Cape Town, he works, say, the first 15 minutes. He sits back, asks for a cup of coffee, and engages in his favorite topic, which is what a great airline this would be if only if it wasn't for management. It's really always been there. What I wanted from the pilots was really just some sort of benchmark on the utilization. And what would generally happen with pilots, like all unions, the pilot union's exactly the same as NUMSA, Solidarity, no difference. It's always about more pay, less work. But the pilots, obviously, they're quite sophisticated, so they aren't going to come to you and say, I want more pay, less work. They're always going to say, we have some safety concerns. So there'll be, it's generally dressed up around safety. We really don't want to do this and do that because there's safety implications. But once you break it down, it's always more work, or sorry, more pay, less work. My second stint at Comair, probably the Comair pilots were earning 40% more than SAFE's pilots. And their productivity, we were doing about 60 hours per month flying. SAFE's probably doing 85 hours. So you can see productivity. We were 60-70% down compared to SAFE. So it was a fight that had to be fought. We had to bring headcount down, and we had to push productivity up. And obviously, that creates a lot of resentments. I suppose particularly if you're an accountant, because generally the report from the pilots will be, well, he's an accountant, he doesn't understand how airlines work, or something like that. But it's a fight that has to be fought. It's been fought at SAA. SAFE never had to fight that fight because they started with a clean slate. But it was a fight that had to be fought at Comair. I don't know, maybe a small part of me, I enjoyed the fight. I don't know.
Well, I think that comes through in the book. You did enjoy the fights. The last issue I want to touch on, I think, is the one that is freshest in people's minds, and that is the demise of Comair, which what is that's your third stint at Comair, where you were put in this situation where you were working alongside as co-CEOs with Ranelle Stander, and her background in aviation had been that she had been the CEO of Air Traffic and Navigation Services, so there was an aviation angle to her. It was you were oil and water, weren't you? But What I found very interesting, Glenn, is that you feel that there were forces working against Khmer. It could have been saved. Without giving too much away, because I think for anybody who wants to know it must go out and buy the book, but give us your appraisal now as you're able to sit back and look at it again. How could Khmer have been saved? Obviously, COVID had a major part, and if we think about that, it's invasion of Iraq, it's Twin Towers, it's COVID. Three things that you couldn't predict, you couldn't control, all had an impact. But give us your assessment on Khmer.
Yeah, so it was one of my second phase of Khmer that was Ronald and I working as joint CEOs. And as you say, it was, or as I say in the book, it was really a bad marriage. It was a bad courtship, a bad marriage, and a bitter divorce.
Because you've got the three phases. I'm trying to remember which one was which. Okay, so Ronel and you were second phase. Third phase is when Khmer went down. That's the one I'm curious to hear about.
The third phase, it would be really convenient to say that we failed at Khmer because of COVID. But that would just be convenient. It wouldn't be correct because SAFE survived COVID, Air Link survived COVID. In fact, they survived and prospered. So it would be convenient to blame COVID, which I think would be incorrect. It would also be convenient to blame the civil aviation who grounded us, in my view, without any reason. But once again, Air Link are being grounded, SAA being grounded in the past, and they've survived. So, what I've tried to avoid is a trap of saying we failed because of these external events that happened. And it's a lot more fundamental why Khmer failed. So I try and talk about the root cause of why Khmer failed. And it's really talking about the root cause. Like an aircraft crash, you always have to identify the root cause. So if an aircraft goes off the runway, the root cause is not that the aircraft went off the runway. The root cause is that maybe the pilot landed with a tailwind, or he landed too deep, or his training was inadequate, or recruitment was inadequate. You need to go all the way back in order to get the root cause. So I'm trying to, I try and explain that in the book, that it's not the external shocks, because the other guy survived. It's something else. And I try and isolate that root cause in the book.
Do you look back at the demise of Khmer with any bitterness, regret at all, Glenn? How are you able to make peace with yourself and the end of Khmer?
Zero bitterness. I think my whole career I've got zero bitterness. So I've worked at three or four airlines, and I have fond memories of all four. Really zero bitterness. I learn each time. Hopefully, my view was always that I leave the airline in a stronger position than when I arrived. That happened at Sunny. It happened at one time. It happened my first and second stint at Khmer. So I really am not bitter at all. I'm not bitter about any of the individuals. It's just I talk a lot about the individuals only insofar as this is how individuals affected the industry, how their personalities have driven decisions and so forth. So when it comes to Khmer, I've got fond memories. I obviously feel for the staff who lost their jobs. A lot of them have not found jobs. So if 1,000 people have lost their jobs, that's probably feeding 6,000 people. And there's associated industries for another 6,000. So probably today there's 10,000 people who might be struggling to put food on the table. So I have I've got a lot of empathy for those people. I don't have empathy for the banks or all the other stakeholders. I have empathy for those people. What is sad about Khmer is it was avoidable. It needed a stakeholder solution, and the stakeholder solution was there. It could have been done, and it wasn't. That is really the sad part, the people who don't have jobs. The stakeholders, the other stakeholders, I have less empathy for them.
Are you referring specifically here to the banks? The banks could have actually saved Khmer.
It's actually all the stakeholders in the end, because the amount we needed was like 6 days of sales. You know, if you try and put in perspective the size of the business, we needed it right in the low season. We would have traded out of that low season in about 3 to 4 weeks after that. The absolute low season is always May. We call it the Russian winter in aviation. And that was when the crunch happened at the end of May. We needed time. We didn't need money. We would have traded out of it. 6 days sales is all we needed. And, you know, the stakeholders, it's everyone. It's the aircraft lessors. It's the trade unions. It's the banks. It's your creditors. It's the aviation authorities. Somehow, if all the stakeholders had just agreed to do a little bit, we would have been able to pull through. But in the end, and I always believed that sanity will prevail in the long term, but I was wrong on that. There was not a single stakeholder who was willing to budge an inch. That's why I'm saying it's avoidable. There was a solution there. It wasn't an impossible number. You know, we're talking about a business that I'm trying to think, what revenue were we doing? Probably 6-7 billion. And you have 120 million where you need a temporary facility is really all we needed to pull through.
Yep, a bit of time, but it's spelt out in great detail in the book. When you wrote the book, Glenn, what did you want to achieve? Was it, you want to expose what actually happened? Was there a sense of a cathartic experience as well? What did you want to get out of writing a book like this?
I think you're right, David. It's all of those. It's obviously traumatic what happened. 74-year-old business failed. I was at the helm. So I needed to reflect on that. So I thought the easiest way is just let me write it down. And I sat down and I wrote the book without notes, without anything. I literally just wrote what was in my mind. I wrote it down from the beginning to the end. And it sort of ended up as a book then. And I presented it to, offered it to the publishers, and I was quite surprised. And they said, no, wait, actually, there's a book here. Obviously, your English isn't great, Glenn, which I own. I spend too much time studying accounting instead of English. They helped me a little bit with that. So it's a few things. It's self-reflection. It's a story that needs to be told. How does a 74-year-old business, an icon in South Africa, fail? It's self-reflection. I was the guy when it happened. And then also it sort of went a bit wider into, well, in the past 30 years, what made Comair great? What made it fail? Who were the individuals involved in the industry in the past 30 years? And somehow I've interacted with almost all of them in one way or another. And I wrote it down and I ended up with a book. Quite surprised that I got accepted then for publishing. I'm not sure if many people are buying it, but we'd wait to see.
Well, I think it's a wonderful read. I think that the way you talk is the way the book is written. You can hear your voice throughout it, and that's makes it a wonderful book to read. For anybody who's interested in the aviation industry, remembers these times, you are going to be taken back, and nationwide, Bop Air, Sun Air, all these names are going to come back, Flight Star. But I think answering the question, how did it go wrong? Why did it go wrong? That's all there in the book, Glenn. I think you've done a wonderful job. I wish you all of the best and much success with the book. And thank you very much for taking time to chat to me.
Oh, thank you, Matt. I really enjoyed it, David. Thank you.
The book is Crash and Burn. It's by Glenn Osmond, available at all good bookstores near you. I'm David O'Sullivan. Goodbye.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.